Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Are you longing for a change of scenery? This week, we're headed for the mountains of Appalachia to explore what's old and new there when it comes to food and drink. First, we'll talk with one of the most inspiring women I've ever met, Troy Ball, whose book, Pure Heart, tells the compelling story of how she became the first legal female moonshine distiller while coping with the demands of raising two special needs sons. Then, Appalachian food historian and icon Ronnie Lundy joins us to talk about vittles, the food that fuels the mountain peoples. Also, the name of her latest book, the James Beard Foundation's Cookbook of the Year. Finally, Fred Minnick gives us a whiskey history lesson as we wash down all those good vittles in true Southern style. There's whiskey in them hills, and a whole lot more, on this week's Louisiana Eats.
I'm Troy Ball, the author of Pure Heart, A Spirited Tale of Grace-Written Whiskey. I'm also the founder of the first whiskey distillery in America that was created by a woman, and I currently operate Asheville Distilling Company in Asheville, North Carolina.
Troy Ball didn't drink a drop of alcohol until she was 40 years old. Raised in a religious Texas household and educated at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Troy prides herself on her Southern manners. Describing herself as a, quote, Vanderbilt girl, she favors pressed blue jeans and crisp white blouses and never leaves home without her pearl earrings. So how is it that at the age of 50, this charming Southern belle became the first lawful female distiller of traditional Appalachian moonshine in the South? Hers is a tale of personal and financial struggles, unlikely friendships, and a loving mother determined to do what's best for her two special needs sons. Troy, it is an honor to be able to speak with you. And I have to tell you, after reading Pure Heart, I am definitely one of your biggest fans. So welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you so much, Poppy. It always makes my heart warm because I struggled through the writing of that book and probably upset my husband a little bit too in the process. But, you know, it's our story. It's the story of raising two special needs sons and coming out of a world that was in many ways confined and finding myself at 50 creating a whiskey distillery.
Troy, your story really begins in Austin, Texas, when you and your husband, Charlie, had your first son, Marshall, and then Colton. Take us back to that time in Austin and how that huge life occurrence changed your life.
Yes. You know, I was excited to have my first son, Marshall, and my second son, actually. But when Marshall was born, he was sent home from the hospital healthy. You know, they said he has, you know, normal test scores and everything, and he's in good shape. And then he didn't gain weight, and then he didn't learn to hold his head up, and then he didn't learn to roll over. And by the time he was 5 months old, the pediatrician was starting to get a little alarmed that he was not meeting milestones. And I was in complete denial, of course, because I'm thinking, hey, he's just doing things his way, you know.
Right.
But by the time he was 9 months old, I really had sort of come to realize that there was something not working correctly with Marshall. but they had no diagnosis. And we said, well, if we don't have a diagnosis, we're just going to keep treating him as if he understands everything we're saying and not limit him. That just continue to talk to him and read books to him and treat him as if he was listening. And at, when he was two, his second brother, Colton, was born. And Colton, too, was sent home from the hospital healthy and fine. And then by the time he was 5 months of age, he was having seizures, as Marshall was, it turned out. So now I was in my mid-20s, and I had these two children who required total care and really round-the-clock care because of their seizures. And the fear that, you know, something would happen to them in the middle of the night. You can never be prepared for that. You know, you just are not prepared. You think that you're going to have a child and you're going to take him to the park and he's going to run and play and you're going to put him on the swing and it's all going to be lovely. Or he's going to get to play T-ball or he's going to graduate from high school one day and maybe he'd get to go to college and maybe he'd go to some great college. And you have these dreams for your child the moment they're born.
Right.
And when you are faced with this situation that we were faced with, it is in many ways like you are continuously for the first 10 years mourning things. You know, you're mourning the loss of something, or you're mourning because this child doesn't have friends. You know, he doesn't have people who think of him. And just that alone is something that you have to come to terms with. So I did my very best. You can, any mother would, to try to find the right health solutions, to create the right opportunities. And fortunately, with Marshall, it sort of paid off, that focus and attention, because at the age of three, he, for the first time in his life, activated a toy, and he did it by himself. He was sitting on my lap, facing out, and I was holding the toy at just the right height that had these big buttons, and they played animal sounds when you pushed them. And he leaned forward and pushed one of the buttons with his forehead. And I was like, oh my gosh, Marshall, you made the lion roar. I said, could you do it again? And he leans forward and pushes the button again, the same button.
Oh.
And then I said, do you know where the dog button is? And he leans the other way and he pushes the dog button. And it was like, oh my God. You know, it was like he won the Heisman Trophy. He understands what we're saying to him. And that was monumental.
So at the time, this was all taking place in Austin, and you and Charlie were very successful in development there in Austin, but you decided it was time for a major change. Why did you move your family to Asheville?
Well, you know, because the boys were medically fragile, we just battled with their health. And so the boys would be compromised by allergies, and then they'd get a little virus and they'd have a pneumonia and we'd be in the hospital. And in 2003, Marshall had developed a pneumonia and actually stopped breathing, just flatlined in an ambulance. And that was a shocking, you know, thing to experience. And my husband was just like, you should have seen him at the hospital. I was following in the car. And he was really devastated. And I said, you know what? We just have to try taking the boys someplace else. We'll never forgive ourselves if we didn't try living in a different environment. So we began a hunt for the best small towns in America, did Google searches and all that. And Asheville was showing up on all the lists, and I had never heard of it. But I thought, well, this place keeps showing up. We should drive through there and see what we think. And that's what we did. And Asheville, surprisingly, reminded us of Austin in the 60s. We didn't live there in the 60s, but it was kind of the feeling you got. It was very progressive in a way and full of people who didn't want to leave. And they wore, you know, lots of tattoos and had body piercing even then in 2003.
That was progressive.
And that felt like Austin.
You moved there, and all of a sudden, a character appears on your doorstep virtually and offers you something called a spider leg. Tell us about Forrest Jarrett and the spider leg.
Oh my gosh, Forrest Jarrett is larger than life. I mean, he's like from a step back in time. He's now close to 90, but at that time he was maybe 80, somewhere in his early 80s, and he was a local Madison County man who'd grown up here in the hills, and he eventually became chief of the Southern Railway Railroad. And so he was politically smart, and I think he worked his way right up the chain by handing moonshine out to everybody. And I'm not kidding. Even to this day, he takes moonshine to the politicos. It's like a joke. You know, it's like all in fun. Oh, now don't tell anybody I brought you some moonshine. You know, that kind of thing. Let's just have a little spider leg. And I was looking at him like, what is this? And he goes, oh, you know, it's just that little bitty drizzle that runs down the side of a glass when you pour the moonshine in the jar. It runs down like they do wine, fine wine.
Yes.
Well, basically, this is the legs, but he calls them the spider legs. So I, you know, opened the jar and took a little tiny sniff, and oh my gosh, you know, it burns your nose hair. And when I put a dab on my tongue, it just burned like crazy, and I put the lid back on and I just stored it. I didn't tell him I didn't drink it because I didn't want to offend him. You know, he was kind to bring it to me. And after a while, these jars are just accumulating at my house because he keeps bringing them. And eventually I just got my nerve up and I said, Forrest, you know, I really just don't like this moonshine. I think you should give it to somebody who would enjoy it more. And he said, Troy, don't you know the good stuff never leaves the home place? And I'm like, what are you talking about, Forrest? He goes, I'm saying the good stuff is kept at home. So a couple of months go by, and here comes Forrest up in my driveway one day, and he pulls out another jar of moonshine. He says, I've got something special. And I'm like, oh, God, please, not another jar. And he goes, no, this is the keeper kind, I promise. And so I called my sister. I said, you got to come over here because Forrest brought the keeper kind of moonshine, and I want you to taste it. And so she came over that afternoon, and she tasted it, and she says, my gosh, it is good. And so then I had to try it, and I was very surprised by the difference. Mm. And that night I had a group of women friends coming over who were supposed to be learning how to crew from me, and I happened to ask them would they like to try some of this keeper kind of moonshine, and they're like, well, sure. So I bring the jar of moonshine out and some fruit juice. And oh my God, those five women drank the whole jar. No kidding. I woke up the next morning and I thought, I wonder if that kind of white whiskey is on the market. And what made me think of that was something Ross Perot had said years ago. Ross said, if you want to be successful in a business, you need to study an industry and figure out what's missing. And then that's what you need to focus on, because there'll be a demand for something that's not available. And I remembered it that morning, and I thought I should go down and buy whatever's available and taste it. Well, I bought three products, brought them home, called my sister and said, come back over, we've got to taste these. And so we tasted the three products, and they were not anything like what he had brought us. And that was it. Boy, from that second on, I was very focused on trying to talk Forrest into introducing me to some men that would teach me how to make this moonshine. I basically ended up on a hunt trying to find somebody who made really good whiskey. And that was difficult because a lot of the guys were just making it kind of more for fun than for trying to create a seriously good product. They weren't personally going to drink it. I learned from these old men up in the mountains that there is a pure heart piece of the distillation. And if you just capture the pure heart of the distillation, you are going to get clean, lovely whiskey that doesn't give you a headache and that tastes wonderful and does not burn your mouth. They were selling the heads and tails and keeping the middle, the hearts, for themselves. When I discovered that, I was like, oh my gosh. When I got home, I went out and I bought a pressure cooker because this guy, Clyde, was using a pressure cooker as a still. And I was like, really? And he goes, yeah, this works fine. So I buy this pressure cooker and I bring it home and I bought the pieces and parts so that we could modify that little pressure cooker and turn it into a still. And once I had done that, then I needed to find some corn.
And you found a really special heirloom variety of corn called Crooked Creek Corn. It's just another little bit of serendipity that fell into your lap in the name of John McIntyre.
Yes, John McIntyre's family had had it on their family farm for seven generations.
John then becomes a vital part of your potential business.
Oh, he was like a gift from the gods. I mean, it was John McIntyre is a gentle giant. You know, he's just this lovely, sweet man who's very smart and clever and dependable. And I eventually was able to convince him that if I got a federal permit, could we set up a little test distillery out at his farm? And he agreed once he knew I was going to be legal. Once I got that little permit, we set up the distillery out there, which was only in an 18 by 21 foot building. And it's a small little building. And he would get up at 5 in the morning because that's what time he always got up. So he would start the still. If I wanted to test filtering the whiskey through some sort of exotic charcoal, the next day I'd get there and he would have a bag of charcoal made from cherry wood. I could never have created this distillery without the help of John McIntyre, and for that matter, the help of Forrest Jarrett. I like to say that these are guys with pure hearts too.
When we come back from a short break, Troy Ball's story continues as her moonshine-making hobby becomes the only hope to save her family from financial ruin. Stay tuned. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Brennan's Restaurant. Breakfast at Brennan's, featuring Chef Slade Rushing's updated classic Creole cuisine. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, and private events at 417 Royal Street in the historic French Quarter. Just joining us, we've been speaking with Troy Ball, whose memoir, Pure Heart, tells a very personal story of raising two special needs sons while also, at the age of 50, becoming the first legal female moonshiner in the history of the South. When we last heard from Troy, the year was 2008. She had just received her federal permit and had set up a distillery on her partner John McIntyre's farm in North Carolina. Just as Troy prepared to assemble the final elements needed to take her moonshine to market, the financial markets crashed. Up until then, her husband Charlie had made a good living as a residential real estate developer. But when the real estate market tanked, the family was faced with financial ruin.
It was just terrible. It was terrible. You know, you remember 2008? I mean, how 6 million people in America lost their homes and the real estate market crashed everywhere. Well, we got caught in that. And, you know, I was in the throes of creating the moonshine business when all of this happened. You know, I had already been out there working with the old men. I had already, you know, learn to make some moonshine, but basically we were just producing our first 1,000 cases of whiskey when we basically had to leave our home. Mm. And it was devastating, and I was traumatized by worrying about what I was going to do with my boys, who had to have, you know, a place to live where I could function with them in wheelchairs and I could give them a bath. You know, I mean, it's very complicated to have that level of special needs people in your life. You can't just go anywhere and do things simply. It was more the stress of worrying about them that landed me, you know, with the 911 guys in the house one day. Mm. And that story, I think you remember, is in the book. I could have left that out of the book. Maybe I should have. But I felt like, you know what, it was just kind of the true story of, you know, the unexpected things that go on in our lives. And really maybe what matters is how we get through those times, you know?
Well, you're such an amazing person, Troy, because, you know, now you realize that you've got to somehow really make this business run because you got to take care of everybody. And yet you keep doing the right thing. And the world was just not giving you a break between the still from Germany that's giving you troubles, the bottles turn into a boondoggle, even the labels become a crazy thing, and then the corks give you a surprise.
It was one thing after the next. There's funny things that happened during that trying to get the distillery open, and intense things that happened. The whole thing was a huge learning curve, and we got through it all. And thankfully, the Pure Heart idea and the concept of making Pure Heart whiskey paid off because people appreciated the quality of the spirit. We had a white spirit that was American born that could be used in cocktails. And it seemed so logical to me that there could be a rebirth for American white whiskey or moonshine. And we ended up getting our product in some of the kind of coolest restaurants that were around in the South, and also on the big prestigious properties like Disney. So, you know, at the end of the day, despite the fact that we didn't have a clue what we were doing, I didn't have a clue for sure, we worked our way through a lot of struggles, and we produced a product that won gold medals and makes a killer cocktail. That was my objective.
Well,
who would have thought?
Who would have thought? And who would have thought that the woman who is the first female whiskey distiller in America also has a special needs son who becomes a best-selling author? I mean, talk about a happy ending to a book.
Yeah, well, you know, Hit Marshall's book was just, you know, he wrote a book, right? It was a compilation of things he had written between the ages of 5 and 10 years. So we went back through all of his notebooks. He selected the pieces, and then they were bound into a book called Kiss of God. And that became a huge bestseller because Oprah Winfrey discovered Marshall's book. I can't even begin to explain the power of that. You know, instantly the book was a huge bestseller and sold. It was published in 5 languages and sold all over the world. So Marshall just this winter had a re-release of Kiss of God for its 20th anniversary edition.
Incredible.
And I am shocked, really, and happy to say that he cultivated a friendship with Chris Martin from Coldplay. And Chris wrote the introduction to the re-release of Kiss of God. Can you believe that?
No, it's incredible.
It's unbelievably generous of somebody like a rock star like that to take his time to do something like this for Marshall. And just last week, in fact, I was out with Chris in Beverly Hills at the library, and we did a book event with the two books. Chris came, and he said, "Troy, how do you want to handle this?" And I said, "Well, what do you think we ought to do, Chris?" And he goes, "You ought to just let me interview you." And it was unbelievable. I wish I could tell you what an amazing experience that was and how good I felt for Marshall.
Well, it seems to me, now that I know your story as well as I do, thanks to your beautiful book, that your whole life, despite all the adversities that you got handed, God seemed to always have a bushel full of kisses for you, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, you, there are times in your life when you wonder, right? But it has been rich in content and in love. It's been, I have found amazing people scattered around the country who have supported me or Marshall in their ways. And I've had to become a much stronger person because of some of these things. And I think that that's okay. You know, that's what was needed.
Where do we go? Nobody knows.
Troy Ball, founder of Asheville Distilling Company and author of Pure Heart, a spirited tale of grace, grit, and whiskey.
God give me style and give me grace. God put a smile upon my face.
In the heart of Kentucky, there's no drink more synonymous with the region than bourbon whiskey. Author Fred Minnick is an expert on the matter. His cultural history research spans centuries of American whiskey production. That history shows up in some surprising places, from isolated cabins to the true underbelly. That's underneath the bodices of Prohibition-era women bootleggers. We turn now to Fred for more on all things bourbon. Why in the world could there still be a confusion over whiskey versus bourbon? Is bourbon whiskey? What's this confusion?
Well, I blame the Kentucky distillers for this, because they put it out there that bourbon isn't whiskey. Like, some of them will put it out there like, don't call us whiskey, we're bourbon. And when in fact, whiskey, you know, all bourbon is whiskey, you know, but not all whiskey is bourbon. You know, basically, I tell people that whiskey is a categorical term that basically means distilled grain aged in wood. You've got Scotch whiskey, Canadian whiskey, Irish whiskey, bourbon whiskey, rye whiskey. I mean, the list goes on and on. And they're all broken up by various production methods and what have you. What you need to know about bourbon is that it's predominantly corn and goes into new charred oak.
You know, politics are something that, just like religion, a topic we tend to avoid. But you've plunged right into that topic. So if you would, tell us about bourbon politics.
Well, when we talk about bourbon politics, it really dates back to before bourbon was really a quintessential term in American whiskey. And that's when George Washington and Alexander Hamilton imposed an excise tax on distillers, and it created a little whiskey rebellion. So the first time that we had federal troops ordered to take arms against U.S. citizens was over a whiskey tax, when distillers in Pennsylvania and Maryland revolted against paying taxes for the very country they helped fight for and found. And so, you know, throughout history, if you study it from a pure whiskey perspective, bourbon is right there in the thick of it. More recently, what we have from a political standpoint within the industry is that everyone's suing everyone over, you know, trademark disputes. You know, the most famous one that is on the record is when, you know, the Kentucky Distillers Association, which is the chief lobby group in Kentucky, sued Sazerac, which owns Buffalo Trace, for using the term Kentucky Bourbon Trail. And they end up settling out of court a few years ago, but there's been, you know, some nasty disputes over similar circumstances, and there are some people who can't be in the same room together because of they just don't like each other. But I don't think you're going to find many industries that aren't like that. The difference with bourbon is it's a little bit more dramatic and a little bit more glorified because there's so many people who love bourbon.
After all, it is a flammable spirit, right?
That's right. It is flammable.
I really would like to hear the story about how women saved bourbon.
So when we look at American distilling, there were a lot of people who have been heralded over time. People like Basil Hayden, Jacob Beam, Robert Samuels. You know, these are people who have been heralded through various brands. But there were also slave distillers and women distillers. You know, Jack Daniels recently came out and admitted that it was a slave who taught Jack Daniel how to distill and not actually a reverend, as they have told in many tours.
How in the world did they get that secret out of them in so long? Was somebody holding the fire to their feet on that?
Well, the New York Times did a story on it, and I actually was quoted in that story talking about that. I have a lot of research on slave distillers and how we may never actually know how much they've contributed, but I do know that they've contributed a lot, and all the major players in distilling have tax records of owning slaves. And so, and a lot of times they would be, slaves would be purchased, you know, if they would receive a higher premium if they worked at a, you know, Caribbean distillery. And it's the same with women. You know, women were distilling in the 1700s and 1800s, but just never really received any credit. In fact, based on my research, you know, on archaeological finds, you know, long before I was born, women created beer in Samaria, and women actually created the very first distillation techniques, and they weren't necessarily, they weren't used for alcohol, but the distillation was created by women. What hurt female distillers in the worldview was witchcraft, is because distillation would be connected to witchcraft, and women would be executed in the 1600s for having aqua vitae on their person or having it in their home because it was considered to be, you know, witch's potion and that sort of thing. And so a lot of women were executed who were actually distillers. And so that damaged a lot of the growth of women distillers. But in America, there were several women who were running distilleries in Kentucky. The Nelson Greenbrier Distillery was ran by a woman for a large amount of time, and in the late 1800s, that was as big as Jack Daniel's and George Dickel. Where women made probably the biggest impact in American spirit is they were better bootleggers than men during Prohibition.
Was it the skirts? What was that about?
You know, for the time, it was considered uncouth for a man to suspect a woman of any kind of criminal activity. And so syndicates would begin bringing in women to bootleg and drive and, you know, send all of the barrels of whiskey or beer or rum or whatever it was, and because they wouldn't be suspected. This became such a problem that around 1925, the Treasury Agency believed that female bootleggers outnumbered men bootleggers by 5-1. They were very prolific, and that creation of a new style of criminal led to female officers. And so women bootleggers created this whole industry of women cops because men couldn't search women. It was actually illegal for a woman to be searched by a man in many states. And so there was that aspect, and then there was also the women who climbed to the top and created their own businesses. Prior to Prohibition, there was this woman named Clea Lithgow, and she moved to the Bahamas and set up a legitimate wholesale company. And she had acquired rums and scotches and ryes prior to Prohibition, and then turned around and sold it to a guy by the name of the real Bill McCoy, who imported it back in the United States illegally, but imported it nonetheless. And so she created this, and, you know, she became known as the Queen of the Bootleggers, actually got arrested here in New Orleans, stood trial and all that, was found innocent of her crimes because the two people who had her boat admitted to stealing it. If you think about a woman who has the power to run her own rum running and whiskey running business in Prohibition, if you work for her, you're probably a little afraid to turn around and rat on her. So I've always thought that she probably convinced them not to tell the truth. But she was a very interesting character. Also in Prohibition, a woman by the name of Mary Dowling worked with her family in Kentucky to move their distillery from Kentucky to Juarez, Mexico, and they made Mexican bourbon during Prohibition and brought it into the United States. And Mexican bourbon would actually be a thorn in the side of American distillers for a very long time. And that was the chief reason why they pursued to make bourbon a unique product of the United States in 1964.
Well, that's great. I just want to thank you so much, Fred, for...
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Love talking bourbon with you anytime. Please come back and see us again.
You got it.
Fred Minnick, author and whiskey expert.
I'll do my time, I'll pay my fine. Ain't nothing wrong with what I do. Jesus turned the water to wine. Wouldn't I make him a bootlegger too?
How do you cook leather breeches? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blended beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How do you cook leather breeches? First, we'd better explore what leather breeches are. Leather breeches are a classic dish of Appalachia. They're pole beans, like yellow wax or green beans, that are dried, a method of preserving taught to early settlers by the Cherokee Indians. The beans are rinsed and the stems are removed before being strung whole and hung to dry. Leather breeches last almost indefinitely once dried, but if you're going to try this at home in Louisiana, I strongly suggest you hang your leather breeches in your air-conditioned kitchen instead of outdoors as they do in the mountains of Appalachia. Louisiana's humidity simply won't allow for proper outdoor drying. So be prepared to have the beans festoon your kitchen for at least 2.5 weeks before they're fully dried. Why go to all this trouble to cook beans? James Beard Award-winning Southern chef Sean Brock says that the drying creates so much umami that the resulting pot liquor tastes like roast beef. When revived in a pot of water with a smoky ham hock, the skins of leather breeches become silky and almost dissolve on the tongue, while the beans take on a velvety texture. Yum! So string up those leather breeches and get ready for a real Appalachian treat. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
My home's in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and I ain't going back there anymore.
Appalachia, or more specifically the Appalachian Mountains, range from northern Alabama all the way to Canada. Yet when we speak of the people of Appalachia and their food and culture, we're talking about the South. Even today, the region remains fairly isolated, something that's helped it gain almost mythical notoriety. Appalachian icon and author Ronnie Lundy has devoted much of her life to studying and preserving the foodways of Appalachia. Ronnie's research separates myth from fact to give us a better understanding of the people and their victuals.
What I was looking at when I wanted to talk about victuals, the victuals of the region, what I wanted to do was to talk about the parts of the region that are known as Southern Appalachia or sometimes Central and Southern Appalachian. And what defines them, when you look at the larder or the table of this region, what you see is that it is a fundamentally southern larder. You'll see a lot of the things that are very familiar to all of us who write about southern food, pork used not just as a centerpiece, but also as a seasoning and cured in many different ways. The whole hog used, chicken, of course. Beef is a lesser presence. Not, certainly it's there, but it's not the primary meat in the way that pork or chicken or game is even. And then this tremendous southern garden with a lot of emphasis on green beans and butter beans and lots of greens, cornbread as the primary bread, and quick breads made with winter wheat like biscuits coming into the equation. So the southern larder is there, this thing that those of us who write about southern food would recognize very, very quickly. But what distinguishes the southern Appalachians from the rest of the South is that because of our latitude and our altitude and the topography, we have very, very severe winters and very limited growing seasons. And then we had to develop these techniques of putting food aside for the winter. So in Appalachian cuisine, we dry foods that aren't dried other places, like shuck beans, our leather breeches, our whole green beans with a nice big bean in the pod, but they're dried in the pod, and then they're cooked again in the winter. They're reconstituted. The pod and the bean both are simmered and served up, and that's something that's done only in the southern Appalachians, the Ozarks, and in parts of Germany, interestingly enough. When we're talking about green beans, we are not talking about those things that look like fat pieces of grass that you buy in the grocery that either don't have a bean or have like remembrance of beans past or whatever. And you know what I mean?
Yes.
That sort of pale looking little thing. When we talk about a green bean, we are talking about a green pod that is filled with beans. Beans inside the green bean give you protein, and then you still get that wonderful green pod.
Well, of course, we are all familiar with the coal mines of Appalachia, but I am not sure that people are really aware about the salt of Appalachia. And of course, through history, from almost the dawn of time, he who has the salt is often king or very wealthy. And this is something that goes far back, and salt really plays a very important role in Appalachian foodways.
That was not just because it was such a delicious seasoning, but because it was a method of preserving food, again, so you can eat through the winter. And it plays a huge role in part of what distinguishes Appalachian cuisine from other southern foods. We fermented in salt a number of foods that were not fermented elsewhere. Obviously, sauerkraut was in many places, but in the Appalachian Mountains, the German settlers took those green beans that were so prolific, and there were so many varieties of them in the Appalachian Mountains, and they salted them down in crocks, and they took corn, which they, of course, had not, you know, came from the New World, and they took corn and scraped it off the cob, or sometimes even put pieces of the cob in crocks with salt and salted that down, and it was allowed to ferment and to keep through the winter. And when you wanted to eat, when you needed a main dish, you would drain the beans or the corn, or sometimes the two together. You drain off the brine, and then you would put that in a skillet, again with bacon grease or lard or some sort of meat fat, and you would warm it up and cook it, let it brown just a little bit, and that was served as a main dish with cornbread.
So that's what would be referred to as sour corn.
Sour corn and pickled beans, they were called.
So interesting to me, because it seems like the world is always fixated on sweet corn. So I never heard about sour corn before.
Let me tell you something. Once you taste it, you will not want to stop eating it. And I will tell you that I have trouble finding fresh corn that I want to eat anymore, because we have moved farther and farther and farther in the direction of sweeter and sweeter corn. And that's not the taste I want. I want a corn taste. I want something that is creamy and taste of the field and has a sort of earthiness to it. And I find that at my produce market, if I go to the older produce farmers and I ask if they have any corn that's not so sweet in the back, they'll look at me trying to figure out if I mean what I'm saying, but then they'll go pull some things out that they grow for their own families.
Ronnie, we would be remiss in moving on from the topic of corn without discussing corn liquor. So could you tell us, what does it mean to have a case of Jake Leg?
And that's a case like a medical case, not like a wooden bin full of some sort of liquor. The tradition of making a homemade liquor was something that from the very beginning was happening in the Appalachian Mountains. In fact, when the frontier was being settled, people initially didn't trust the water, which is kind of ironic because it was beautiful water at that time. But in the era of Prohibition, when suddenly it was illegal, people were making it and making a lot of shortcuts in it. The liquor that was made had some sort of chemical in it. Sometimes it would be even a battery acid or something chemically that they had added to kind of up the fermentation process so they could get it out on the street and make money faster. And Jake Leg is a condition that's caused when the liquor you drink can cause paralysis.
Oh.
And part of the story about the Jake Leg is that when you would drink it, then you would walk. One of your legs would sort of have, I call it a flop foot walk, and you sort of, you stumble, and then eventually for most people it would go away as the liquor wore off. So this happened in the town that I grew up in Corbin, Kentucky. And men all around the town had this walk, and it was a scandal, and everyone kept waiting for the county judge and the sheriff to bring somebody in, or press charges. But nobody saw the county judge and sheriff for a couple of days, and then when they finally did show their faces, come back out, the remnants of that Jake Leg walk were still obvious in both of them. So obviously they'd been into the same bad liquor as everybody else.
Well, you've got to absolutely love the Appalachia of old and of new. And
absolutely.
It's so wonderful the way you've encapsulated it all within the pages of your beautiful new book.
Oh, Poppy, thank you so much. This was such a wonderful interview, and I really appreciate your good questions.
Ronnie Lundy, author of Vittles, named Cookbook of the Year by the James Beard Foundation. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we'll explore the influence of the South on America's culinary identity with John T. Edge.
Cultures evolve. Culture is a process, not a product. And the process inspires me.
Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. If you love Louisiana Eats, let others know and help like-minded Louisiana food lovers find our show by leaving a review on iTunes. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from Tableau, Dickie Brennan's latest restaurant serving local Creole cuisine with a view of Jackson Square. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook as well. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.